Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Lisa Schmeiser.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Can you remind everyone out there who you are and where they might have heard you?
Sure thing. Although in the day job, I'm a tech reporter and editor. I'm on The Incomparable, often on the flagship podcast. I am currently the host of I Want My MCU TV, which is a weekly look at the MCU TV shows on the Disney Plus network. And I also have a podcast I co-host called Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies, where we review movies based solely on their trailers. I also just wrapped up co-hosting the podcast, Erica Enzen and I did it, and I'm completely blanking. It was basically we reread Julian May's entire Remillard saga, and when I can remember the name of the podcast, I'm sure I'll introduce it. I co-host a lot of podcasts. One of them was bound to fall through the cracks.
This time we are doing the cycle of poems known as the Spoon River Anthology by Edgar Lee Masters. It was published in 1911, I think, the full version. Let me check my notes here.
I thought it was a few years later.
Let me see here. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Because the poems had begun appearing initially in 1914.
You are correct. It is 1915. Mm-hmm. was the collection. These poems were originally published. Most of them were originally published serially in a literary journal called Reedy's Mirror. A lot of poetry was published in this form. In fact, a lot of poetry was published in newspapers back in the day. This is about synchronous with one of my favorite collections of poetry, Archie and Mehetabel, which was published as a series of newspaper pieces. This is a little bit more highfalutin than Archie and Mehetabel. And this was your choice. You want to talk a little bit about your interest in Spoon River Anthology?
It was, you mentioned sophomore reading lists, and this was actually a completely accidental discovery because the poems were in my high school's literature reader, but we didn't cover them in class. I ended up reading them because I would get bored in class and just start surreptitiously reading my way through the English book every year. This is actually how I got introduced to Gwendolyn Brooks poems, for example, because we never covered those in school either. And what I remember was reading one of the poems in Spoon River Anthology and noting that it was part of a larger group of poems where it's all of the voices from a town. And as a comics book loving high schooler, and as somebody who's always really enjoyed literary devices like Slightly Supernatural, The Dead Speak, or alternate conflicting perspectives on the same point of view or alternate histories, I was like, oh, this kind of sounds like my jam. So I went to the library, checked out the Spoon River Anthology, and read it on my own as a high schooler, and was just kind of gobsmacked at the different stories that were in there, the realization that several of them were interrelated, and then some of the tragedies are just unspeakable, but you've also got these poems with incredible joy, and Masters has many really beautiful and profound lines, and so it's been something that's always just kind of clanged around the back of my head since I was a teenager. And when you're looking for ideas for your podcast, I thought, well, I found this when I was 15, so why not?
Yeah, no, it is. Spoon River Anthology was an astonishingly successful book in its day. It was a bestseller, and you know, when was the last time a book of poetry was a bestseller in America? It sold something like 80,000 copies in its first 4 years in print, and it was heralded by people as different as Ezra Pound and Carl Sandburg. Reading it through this time, I am struck by how it has sort of one foot in the 19th century and one in the 20th.
Yes.
I should just pause here to say a little bit about my history with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've mentioned before on the podcast, when I was in high school, there was a class that I took called ACS, which stood for American Cultural Studies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a area studies kind of class that was supposed to get people to really engage with literature and art history and history in a broad way. It was very experimental. I think it had been developed in the 70s, and it felt like that post-hippie new curriculum. And we read some of the poems in Spoon River Anthology. We actually had a day late in the year, it was at the end of May, where we all had to go out to Eureka Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And we were each given a poem from this book, and we were supposed to find a gravestone and read the poem to that gravestone. So that was the kind of that was my introduction to this, and it suited me as a kind of a morbid child.
Yeah.
and a child who had the kind of a romantic streak in me. I then went on to try to read the whole thing, and it's a lot of poems, and a lot of them are similar to each other.
Oh yes. There are 244 separate characters name checked through this Spoon River Anthology, and he claims there's 19 separate storylines. I think there's more.
Yeah, there are ones that are subtler, where there's maybe five or six in a row.
Mm-hmm.
That are telling the same plot line from different characters over different generations, from different points of views. There are some where someone will mention a name, and if you aren't paying attention, you won't notice when that name comes up again.
Mm-hmm.
16 poems down the line.
Yeah.
And then there are ones that are very, very simple. It's like a husband and a wife buried together, telling their sad story of their mm-hmm. failed relationship. So this is, for anyone who doesn't know it, this is a collection of stories about a fictional town, Spoon River, Illinois. There is actually a Spoon River in Illinois. There is no town of Spoon River in Illinois. Spoon River is near Peoria, Illinois, which also makes it close to my heart, because Eureka, Illinois was 17 miles from Peoria. And so this was basically my stomping grounds that were being written about here. The conceit is that we're going to listen to these 244 dead souls of Spoon River tell their story in blank verse, sometimes just three or four lines, sometimes two or three pages, none of them very long, all of them very, very patchwork, very partial views into these people's lives. To be honest, this is the first time since I was in college that I've actually read this through as a whole. What were your feelings reading it through this time?
I was really grateful that I was reading it on a Kindle, to be frank. And I don't know if you did this too. I started doing a lot of searching for specific names, because like you point out, sometimes the name references are very, very subtle. And it made it easier to hop back and forth and read two sides of the same story sometimes, or to read how different events in a story stand out for different people. For example, there's a cluster of poems called Minerva Jones, Indignation Jones, Dr. Myers, Mrs. Myers, and Butch Weldy. And what happens over the course of these poems. The event that all of them allude to in one way or another is that poor Minerva Jones is chased down in the street and raped by Butch Weldy. She becomes pregnant from the encounter. Doc Myers tries to give her an abortion to help her out. She dies as a result of the abortion. He's disgraced. Her father becomes like the town madman, the town outcast. Mrs. Myers retreats into piety, and Butch Weldy sells this story where I've stopped running around, I've gotten religion, I've settled down, and then he's fatally wounded in an industrial accident. And you know, you don't, like, the poem doesn't lay all of this out. You have to kind of put the bits and pieces together from all of them. And what I loved and appreciated this time out is I could put all of these together, and then I could go back and pay attention to what the characters were saying about themselves. Because, you know, for Minerva Jones, she insists that she thinks of herself not as a victim, and not as somebody who just got dealt one bad hand after another, but she's somebody who, I dedicated my life to art and love and life, and I didn't ever want to leave it. And Dr. Myers, I just wanted to be somebody who everybody in the town could turn to no matter what. And Butch Weldy doesn't even mention Minerva by name. Like, this event that cost one person her life and led to another one's early death, that caused one person to sink into madness and another one to sink into a sort of unyielding piety. His only allusion to it is, after I got religion and steadied down. And I was very, very struck by how deftly Edgar Lee Masters is able to put these events into context and show us what's important to the characters by what they do and don't say. And I'm not sure, I didn't pick that up as a teenager, for sure. I would have been just like reading through going, oh, this one's connected to this one. I see now. And this way I could like sit and sink with let it sink in a little bit more, sit with it, search if I had to.
I think the Minerva Jones section is probably the highlight of the book as far as that sort of cross-referential storytelling and the points that Masters wants to make about how everyone sees the events in different ways and how people can seem pathetic, but maybe not view their own lives as pathetic. People can see themselves as pious, even though we, as the reader, might see them as hypocritical. And throughout this this sequence, there's a lot of injustice being meted out. Mm-hmm. And we, as readers, are invited to reflect on that. There was later in the book, there's a story of a love triangle, Tom Merritt and his wife, Mrs. Merritt, who has an affair with a local teenage boy.
Yes, that's right.
And the teenage boy kills the husband.
Yes.
And the woman, Mrs. Merritt, talks about how she was silent before the jury, returning no word to the judge when he asked me if I had aught to say against the sentence, only shaking my head. Mm-hmm. What could I say to people who thought that a woman at 35 was at fault? She did not kill her husband. Mm-hmm. It was her lover who did. But she's given 30 years in prison.
Yes.
And teenage lover who kills her, Elmer Carr, in the next poem talks about how he was given 14 years in prison. And besides that, when he got out, he says, oh, the loving hearts that took me in again. Oh, the helping hands that in the church received me and heard with tears my penitent confession, who took the sacrament of bread and wine. Repent, ye living ones, and rest with Jesus. You know, it's a very harsh look at the unfairness of this, it's not that we don't believe that Elmer hasn't had a change of heart and couldn't have maybe gotten some redemption in prison. It's just that he's given the opportunity to do so, and she's not.
the sheer number of women who die in childbirth in this book is just, it's reflective of the times, but it's also, when reading it from a modern perspective, it's really kind of horrifying too, because you realize there's the poem Amanda Barker. And I'm going to read that one really quickly because it's tremendously haunting. Henry got me with child, knowing I could not bring forth life without losing my own. In my youth, therefore, I entered the portals of dust. Traveler, it is believed in the village where I lived that Henry loved me with a husband's love, but I proclaim from the dust that he slew me to gratify my hatred. And, you know, you read that now and you think about how this poor woman is saying, no, the narrative that Henry's putting out is absolutely not true. And then much, much later in the book, there's a poem by Margaret Fuller Slack, who, and the gist of her whole poem is basically, I wanted to be a poet. And then there's a couplet that reads, but there was the old problem. Should it be celibacy, matrimony, or unchastity? And long story short, she picks matrimony. She had 8 children and then ends the poem with, it was all over with me anyway, when I ran the needle into my hand while washing the baby's things and died from lockjaw, an ironical death. Hear me, ambitious souls, sex is the curse of life. And that's a theme that he comes back to again and again and again. I mean, we see it with poor Minerva, and it's not sex in this case, it's abuse. But, you know, the way it's framed in this is that Minerva is a victim of the hazard that a woman faces from any sort of sexual activity, wanted or unwanted. And, you know, you see it with Margaret Fuller Slack, and you see it with so many other wives.
Well, it's the other thing you see with Margaret Fuller Slack is his propensity for naming people after famous authors, famous poets, in this case named after Margaret Fuller, the feminist writer. I think that this reading it through this time, I was impressed by how progressive a lot of Master's ideas were. He obviously has a lot of sympathy for the female characters. There's a poem, Sarah Brown, which is about this woman reflecting on the fact that her husband is mourns her, but also mourns the fact that she had a lover. And she says, go to the good heart that is my husband, who broods upon what he calls our guilty love. Tell him that my love for you, no less than my love for him, wrought out my destiny, that through the flesh I won spirit, and through spirit peace. There is no marriage in heaven, but there is love. The weird thing about these dead people is they don't really spend a lot of time talking about what the afterlife is like. For the most part, they seem fixated on revisiting their lives. Most of them are kind of bitter about their lives. Some of them are not bitter about their lives, but they're still pretty fixated on the past. Here we have this vision of heaven as being a being above marriage in some way, and I you get these little glimmers through the poetry that Masters sees marriage as kind of a raw deal for most people, but especially for women.
Which is, apparently he had a terrible first marriage, and his first wife, when she sued for divorce, was actually represented by his then law partner Clarence Darrow. So, like, I feel like there's a little, but there is, for a man of his time and place, an unusual recognition in the burdens that were uniquely female at that time and that place for women. And he doesn't call them out explicitly, but he does make it known. And I also do find that the counterpoint to that is he's got a couple of poems from women who bucked convention in Spoon River, and their poems are so much happier for it. My favorite example of that is Russian Sonia, where she's like, you think I married this guy? And she's an immigrant who comes to Spoon River with a husband named Patrick Hummer who was on the boat. And she's like, oh, you guys thought we were married. We never were. Life is really fun and life is frankly pretty great. And then there's a mother-daughter dyad. Let me see if I can pull up the bookmark for that too. Dora Williams and Mrs. Williams. And Dora Williams had had a bad love affair with another poem featured, Reuben Pantier. But she had, long story short, she becomes an expatriate in Paris right around the time of The Lost Generation. And she dies after having been poisoned by her third husband, who happened to be an Italian count. But she's like really pretty happy with the way her life went. She's like, nah, he poisoned me, I think. And now I overlook the sea where young Columbus dream new worlds. And then the poem immediately after that is her mother's. And, you know, her mother's like, well, you know, you all talked about my daughter, but I put it to you that having a life devoted to beauty is not the worst thing in the world. And those of you who lost your husbands to beautiful people, maybe you could have looked a little harder at your own love of beauty.
Right. She says, yeah, they should wear a hat once in a while.
Hats may make divorces. They also prevent them.
And hats then, must have been really sexy at the time, yeah, or something. I don't know.
Well, I love how she finishes her poem, which is, well, now, let me ask you, if all of the children born here in Spoon River had been reared by the county somewhere on a farm, and the fathers and mothers had been given their freedom to live and enjoy, change mates as they wished, do you think that Spoon River would have been any the worse? And I just love that she puts that idea like right out there, and she's cheerfully unrepentant about the way that she lived life and what she and her daughter got out of it. So it's just, it's such a lovely and complicated picture.
I think Masters is extremely gracious to a lot of the women in here. He's also, though, he does take some of the men to task. A lot of them mostly for hypocrisy. There's a lot of people. This is the weird thing. These people are dead, and they talk about their lives. It seems that in death they are unable to lie about things anymore. So if they had been disingenuous in life, they admit so after death. There was the circuit judge who says he never awarded anything on the merits of the case, but only on the skill of the lawyer. And that's nice, but it leads me to wonder a lot about sort of the mechanics of these dead people. You know, you mentioned the woman who dies in Italy and now is looking over the sea where Columbus dreamed. Why is she here in Spoon River then too? I don't understand. Yeah.
She visits her mom, I think.
Yes, I guess there must be some sort of an airline that handles afterlife, and you know they look for a good rate. You know the off season. The thing that I find informative is this collection is very often compared to Our Town, and it's also very often compared to Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood. And in all those cases, we have a place being described through the voices of people, and quite and in each of those, some of those people are dead, and there's this approach to death as the moment of clarity where you can look back on life and judge what's happened. But what's different about this from, say, Our Town? In Our Town, when Emily dies and she talks to the other people around her who are dead, the reality of death in Thurber's world, not Thurber,
Thornton and Wilder's world.
Thornton Wilder's world, yes, is that you eventually lose interest in life. You know, your perspective shifts, and you become less and less moored to this world until eventually you cross over into whatever concerns people for eternity. the people of Spoon River are obsessed with their lives in mm-hmm. some ways, with some very small instances in their lives, and they keep repeating them and repeating them over and over. That's a kind of a sad idea to me. You know, it's a and they also, because they can't lie about what they did in life, they admit some very harsh truths about themselves. I do know that this this collection was banned in the small town, in Illinois that Masters was from, because the people there all thought that he was basically roasting them in front of the rest of the world, that he was basically saying small towns are full of hypocrites. And
well, he was. I mean, you know, you take a look at when he landed. It was at a pretty significant inflection point in American literary history, right? Because he's like right at the beginning of American literary realism with Theodore Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis, and like you said, Thornton Wilder. And I read somewhere those guys are often known as, quote unquote, the revolt from the village. And the leitmotif that runs through all four of them is the idea that even while small towns were springing up like mushrooms across, you know, the American Middle West, and even as they were being invented along railroad lines and in places that were just becoming states, they were mythologizing themselves, and that mythology was unearned. Like, that's kind of the through line in all of their stuff. And what I like a lot about Spoon River Anthology is that you can see there are dead who are still really heavily invested in that myth, and we'll go on and on about it, and how it's served the community. There's the editor, what is his last name? Editor Whedon, who argues that, oh, you know, without him, you know, Spoon River wouldn't have known what to think thanks to his paper. Every time you hear from a religious figure, they talk about what they did to keep Spoon River going. There's one who comes on the heels of a poem from an unhappy wife who's like, this made my kids suffer because, you know, we had people who were just really unhappy under one roof, and you can't raise healthy people in an unhealthy environment. And the next poem is from Reverend Wiley, who's all, no deed of mine shines brighter in the memory of the world, and none is treasured more than me. Look how I saved the Blisses from divorce and kept the children free from that disgrace. So, you know, he's always finding ways to poke holes in that mythologizing. To be honest, the story you just shared with me, where there was a town that banned it because, oh my gosh, he's roasting us. You couldn't find like a more perfect example of precisely the mindset that Masters is parodying in Spoon River Anthology, because probably no one outside that town would have known who any of the people he was sending up were.
I found the reference. It was Lewistown, mm-hmm. and the book was banned in Lewistown until 1974.
Oh my gosh.
This is from Wikipedia. Even Master's mother, who sat on the Lewistown Library Board, voted for the ban.
They apparently had a pretty... Edgar Lee Masters and his mother apparently had a relationship that was... he made it clear to his mother that he respected his father more. So so who knows? Maybe this is her getting a little of her own back. But
when I was reading this through, the other thing that I was thinking about was Winesburg, Ohio, another story of a small town in the Midwest that's told through a bunch of interrelated stories. What I think that Masters shares with Anderson is some of the characters in here are a little bit ridiculous. They're a little bit over the top. There's a lot of poets. There's a lot of painters. There's a lot of actors and people traveling the world and having some there's some absurd things. There's like a botanist who believes that plants are intelligent. You know, that's kind of just thrown in as a sort of a joke. There's a gentleman who wants to write a heroic history of Spoon River, which we get a bit of an excerpt from that at the end of the book, that he calls the Spooniad. And those, all those things are a little bit silly, and it reminds me of the fact that when you read Winesburg, Ohio, Anderson calls his characters the grotesques, that they are broadly drawn, they are in some ways absurd, they're caricatures in some ways, and I think that probably did not endear Masters to people of Illinois anymore than anything else. But the other thing that I noticed reading through this time was the absolute relentless number of classical allusions in these poems. There's allusions to, you know, Homer. There's allusions to Virgil. There's allusions to Dante. There's all the part of what bugs me about that is I know that in the 19th century that was what it meant to be educated. It was that you knew what the classics were, but there's a point at which, for example, the Lothario, the Don Juan of the town, dies, and he says, "Over here," meaning in the afterlife, "there is a powerful shade that goes on about his love of Beatrice." And he's right, exactly. Well, the thing is, it smacks me as sort of disingenuous, because I think Masters is just like, haha, you get it, what I'm doing here, huh? You've read the Inferno, mm-hmm. haven't you? And
I think there's a little bit of showing off. You know, I feel like I'm reading Louisa May Alcott with my daughter right now. My daughter is 10, and we're just, you know, dipping a toe in and getting started. And one of the things that has slowed us down considerably is there are a lot of references that we do have to stop and explain out to her, like the story of Cupid and Psyche has come up in one of the books that we're reading, for example. And so we've had to go through and backtrack. And I thought, okay, this might just be, this might be like making a pop culture allusion today, where in the 1800s, that's what you did, is you read your Greek and your Roman stories and you dropped them in because that was a really handy shorthand. And Edgar Lee Masters is somebody who was educated in the 19th century and brought that education with him into the 20th century. And even though he helped invent really modern traditions in, you know, Revolting from the Village and in Blank Verse, and I'd argue that his, just the framing device around Spoon River Anthology and the way that he's effectively created like the MCU of poetry here with, you know, Spoon River and all the interlocking stories, like those are innovative. But this is a guy whose values, whose framing of values, if I don't think his values are necessarily 19th century, but I think the way he insists on framing moral debates and the references that he uses to broadcast shorthand to his reader, I think those are very much the product of a 19th century education. And yeah, it's super heavy in the classics. And this is how Americans who are insecure about being a brash, young, uncultured country would broadcast that they were just as worthy to be on an international stage of letters and culture, is they'd be like, I've had the same fine education you've all had in Europe. I've managed to read the same books you've read here, and here's what I'm bringing to it.
Your point about the anxiety that Americans felt is absolutely spot on. There was anxiety both in the visual arts and certainly in literature. It makes me think especially of Willa Cather's My Antonia, which was a few years later, 1918. One of the points that's being made in My Antonia is that the hero of the book, Jim Burden, goes to university to study the classics, and he wants to write about Nebraska and bring something of the classical world to his description of this place, and he keeps quoting Virgil's Georgics, and it specifically was Virgil's attempt to take Greek poetry and instill it into the Italian tradition. He says, Jim Burden is saying, I'm going to do the same thing here for America. And I think that that's what Masters is trying to do. It just still kind of bugs me. You know, it feels kind of disingenuous. Yeah. There was also like a blind fiddler. And he says, there's a blind poet here who talks about the fall of Troy. And I'm like, if you know what Troy is, why don't you know who Homer is? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But I like what you also say about Louisa May Alcott. That reminds me that in the Little House books, at one point, Laura talks about how happy they are that they got a copy of the complete poems of Tennyson.
Yes,
and they're out there on the prairie, and the thing that they love the most is they have this complete works of Tennyson that they'll be able to read. As in the long prairie nights. I actually was able to find a copy of that edition and get it for my wife.
Well, it speaks to one of the central conflicts of the Little House series, which is the lure of wild freedom versus civilizing influences and how to have those in balance, because like Pa and Ma obviously, and here we're veering wildly away from one set of poems to like a series that's going to be written, 15 years later and establish a bunch of founding myths for American conceptions of prairie life. But yeah, that's, you know, Ma is the civilizing force and Pa is the lure of opportunity, of wild opportunity in the West. And they balance themselves out thusly. Like there's that real implication that both are needful of, but they have to go together somehow, and navigating that tension is one of your duties as an American. That comes through in that series. But yeah, it's very much, you get all these references, don't you? And I like to imagine that people who did pick up these poems from newspapers and things like that may have just been kind of like, okay, let me see, do I need to go to the library for this reference? Or they may have, you know, eavesdropped and chatted with each other, and there would have been a really social aspect to crowdsourcing exactly what all these allusions were.
Right. Well, what I think is ironic about this is this is all happening in America. And certainly there's also attempts in American painting to create sort of American history painting. And people are trying to impose history and civilization on America because people are worried that they don't have history and civilization. And then just a few years earlier, you have Joseph Conrad writing Heart of Darkness, and that opens with the sequence where Marlowe says about London, this also was one of the dark places of the earth. We were the uncivilized at one point when Rome came here. That was what modernism did to England, was it got them to consider themselves as, you know, we aren't as civilized as we think we are. So, anyway... That's our little mini
excursion,
course in excursion into comparative literature out there, and all you listeners out there, that will definitely be on the test when we wrap up here.
Well, what I was thinking was, you could easily spend a semester teaching Spoon River Anthology as a history course, where you know, one of the central through lines that goes through many, many of the poems is when the bank collapses and who's affected and who's not and how. And you could go through the bank speculations that were happening at the time and the widening economic instability and economic inequality that were on the upswing when he was writing these poems. And similarly, there are poems from people who were personally affected by the Civil War and have very strong opinions about what America was supposed to be. And there are poems from people who talk about their connections actually to the War for American Independence. And you could do a wonderful class on early 20th century American history just by saying these were the tensions that people were wrestling with in their daily lives, and these are the social attitudes, and this is how the temperance movement was playing out at the time, and this is why you had labor strikes happening. And I don't think Masters meant it that way, but like one of the great things about this kind of literature, which you do get exposed to in school or afterwards, is how it does end up being just a reflection of its times. And it's such a delight to gain deeper understanding of it once you've got more of the historical and cultural context around it.
It's good to bring up the bank failures. A lot of people may not, who don't study the era, may, you know, people know of course, the Great Depression, but what people may not know is that the markets were basically failing pretty rapidly every 20 years or so in the 19th century. And it was just that the Depression was just the worst one. As you say, these towns, these Midwestern towns, if you go to the Midwest today, one of the things that marks these kinds of Midwestern towns is you'll go to these tiny little villages like Eureka, Illinois, where I grew up in, that have maybe 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people living in them. But they have these interesting little city centers that have these gorgeous, Edwardian facades. You know, they were these little boom towns that had come up and industrialization, and the idea at the time was everyone was going to have their little center of production. You know, this place was going to make electric fans, this place was going to make furniture, this place was going to make pianos, you know, and they were all over the place, and every town had its little factory, and that was the way that commerce was going to work in America, and it was all going to be connected by railroads. And that's all gone away. That's all. And you go to little towns in Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and
Iowa,
yeah. and there's ruins there. There's factory ruins that are. Mm-hmm. It's very strange.
One of the things I remember reading about Iowa, because the population density is the exact opposite of dense in a lot of counties, and one of the things I remember reading is the way counties were partitioned out in Iowa was the idea was that a farmer should be able to drive his team to the county seat and back in one day. So if there was urgent legal business to do, or if they wanted to get married to somebody, or they had to file a birth certificate or what have you, they didn't have to take more than a day away from the farm, which is, and so that was the unit conception. That was, you know, was, well, it takes a farmer a day to drive here and back. That was like your basis of measurement and how that went. And in an in a world with automobiles, that doesn't make sense anymore. You know, it's a relic of an earlier time. And with these small towns, it's like that too. You know, you might think at this point that Spoon River might have either fallen into complete disrepair, or it's been absorbed by a larger metropolitan area, and it's the hamlet of Spoon River, and there's like a couple streets of a walkable quote-unquote downtown type area, and maybe a cemetery, but it doesn't have the conception of itself that it would have at the time of writing, when there's the mill, and there was the boiler explosion that set things off, and there's a bank that collapsed, and this microcosm, this little community where when people come in, the reception is mixed. And when people leave, the reception is equally mixed.
They do constantly mention Peoria as the place that people go away to escape Spoon River, to go see the big city. And it's I look upon that with some grim amusement that Peoria is the big city. You know, people may or may not still say the phrase, will it play in Peoria? Peoria is a very depressed city right now. It had the Caterpillar plant, and Caterpillar has moved, I think, a lot of its productions elsewhere. But Peoria was the birthplace for Richard Pryor and for Dan Fogelberg. So we had that going for us, I guess.
It's that I was thinking every state has a Peoria, you know.
the great thing now is that if you look up Eureka, Illinois, mm-hmm. on Wikipedia, my little brother is the number one celebrity out of Eureka, Illinois. So
and think I just want a Wikipedia entry. That's all. One of these days, just to be deemed worthy of Wikipedia inclusion.
That will be your postmortem poem. Will be you saying, you know, I long for
Wikipedia.
Wikipedia.
I think what I really to get back to Spoon River Anthology. What I really love about it is how the poems range from the incredibly petty to the transcendent. And I was thinking about how I would try and sell Spoon River Anthology to young people if you had to teach it today. And I would basically, do you like the MCU? And then you'll love Spoon River, because there's lots of interlocking storylines, and, you know, they all reference each other in some way. And there's all sorts of scandals that go on, and there's all sorts of class conflict, and there's all sorts of love triangles, and there's mayhem, there's murder. and it really is just... For all that, you do have a lot of poems where somebody insists that there's joy or serenity to be found in the quotidian details of existence. Like, this book is remarkably mayhem filled. All sorts of ruptures to personal lives, all sorts of unhappy childhoods that come up. There's at least, I counted like two different reference, like this past blind, I wasn't counting, but there were at least two direct reference, two poems that directly reference child abuse as the thing that precipitates the end of their lives. And it's the kind of thing where you could really give it to a group of young people who, like you point out, have a pretty strong romantic streak. And a lot of kids have a very strong morbid or, you know, ghoulish streak to them too. God knows I did. I mean, Stephen King's stories, I mainline this, and just be like, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to turn the Minerva Jones saga into a revenge story. Tell me how it would go, and then have them reference the poems or things like that. Like, I get very excited about this collection of poetry because it's 100 years old. It's more than 100 years old, and it still feels really fresh, and there's a lot of empathy for everybody. And you can see a lot of our modern civic debates are basically repeats of things people were arguing about a couple hundred years ago. Because there's a couple poems in here that talk about how terribly immigrants were treated, or how they felt as though their cultures were horribly ignored. And, you know, you're seeing
there's a poem today on race relations.
Yes.
There's poems. Yeah, there's... And there's also poetry about comparative religion. As I say, the thing that's a little bit frustrating about this for me is that people don't spend a lot of time, you know, these people are dead. And I always thought that if you were dead and you could talk to the living, one of the first things the living would want to know is like, well, what's it like being dead? And do we have anything right about an afterlife? And what are the rules of the afterlife? There's very little discussion of what the afterlife is like. There's the one woman says she's in nirvana. It's not the way that Buddhists would conceive of nirvana to be in the afterlife. By the end, there's a string of about five of the last ones that deal with sort of rapturous visions of transcendence, whether that be the afterlife or just visions that these people are having. It becomes a little bit diffuse and hard to follow.
It's a little untethered from the rest of the well-observed and empathetic stories that he's been telling. Like, I feel like that by the end of the collection, he's kind of tapped out but has to bring it across the finish line.
Right. Well, what did you think of the Spooniad or the epilogue?
So I really enjoyed the epilogue. But again, like, I had like severe Louisa May Alcott flashbacks. Well, mostly because, and this is something where I've come to it as an adult, and I'm sure that you've covered this on others. Alcott's actually a little young for sophomore lit, but you've probably covered it anyway.
We did do Little Women, yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't realized how much moralizing, like, just how, like, she never passes up the opportunity to put some sermonizing monologue in somebody's mouth. And, you know, when I was reading through the epilogue and he gets to just the array of, you know, malicious divinities that are having their little dialogue and what they're doing, what they're trying to do with men and so on. I'm like, oh my God, come on.
This kind of symbolist drama, you know, that was really big in Europe at the time. Yeah. That's what is being made fun of at the beginning of The Seagull, if you read that, when Constantine puts on his play, and his play is this ridiculous, poetic, symbolist play. This is Masters doing that.
Yeah.
And that this is one of the reasons why I think this collection does straddle the 19th century and the 20th century. It has all these classical allusions. It has some retrograde forms in it, and then it has what we would consider to be absolutely modern confessional naturalism. It's very like Stephen Crane, like Maggie Girl of the Streets. These people are all in some ways doomed by their circumstances. But it's also so full of, I think ultimately it's full of compassion for its characters, which is a nice thing. You know, there are a few characters that I think are drawn for us to, boo at, you know, we're supposed to say, you know, that person is despicable, but for the most part, he avoids that.
And that's... If he were alive and you were able to interview him, it'd be fun to ask him about which characters he connected with the most and which ones he felt necessary to include, and what he had to do to give them a voice that was their own sense of themselves instead of how they were viewed by others. Because, you know, part of the lore of Spoon River Anthology is to see how the characters regard each other. But you can't have that without each of those characters also conveying a sense of self that is wholly separate, independent from what others think of them, too. And he does a great job with that. And I think that's a fairly modern conceit, the idea that you do carry this sense of self through all of the ways that you move the world and you know, how you choose to interpret the things that happen to you and around you as well. But I think we're also in violent agreement that this is a work that straddles the 19th and the 20th centuries. And I know that some of the criticism that came out around Spoon River Anthology came from people who had established themselves during, you know, the Victorian literary establishment and were like, what? You know, this poetry doesn't rhyme. It doesn't say anything elevating.
We're running down to the end here. I just wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite poem or two that you wanted to highlight at the end?
You know, it's funny that you ask. This is a cheery topic. When I was making my... when I was doing my estate planning and drawing up my plans for any sort of memorial service, the one thing I did stipulate was I want the poem Lucinda Matlock read. And that's what I'd prefer to have as my epitaph. And it is one of my favorites, and I come back to it and I read it from time to time, because it is one of those that, as Louisa May Alcott would have put it, it refreshes the spirit, I think. And I really love the end of it, where the last five lines are my favorite. What is this I hear of sorrow and weariness, anger, discontent, and drooping hopes? Degenerate sons and daughters, life is too strong for you. It takes life to love life. And I love that. I love the idea that you have to kind of keep running into life with all of your strength, and the reward will be that you'll just keep loving your life more, even when it's hard. And at the end of it, you quote unquote pass to a sweet repose.
Thanks again to co-host Lisa Schmeiser. Her podcasts are I Want My MCU TV and Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show
at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to join in the discussion, you may do so either on the Facebook page or the Incomparable membership Slack. And however you stay in touch, make sure you keep up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.